prevalence of obesity and pre-obesity reached 60% in the United States in 2016. The rising prevalence of obesity impacts our society in drastic ways. Most importantly is the impact the disease has on the quality of life of people who are afflicted by it and the increased risk of chronic diseases that can result from it. There is not only a shortening of life for people with obesity, but also a decrease in the quality of life during those precious years. The reasons for increasing rates of obesity are at the same time both simple and exceedingly complex. It's simple in concept. Excess calories lead to excess weight gain. However, the reasons why as a population we are consuming excess calories is a long and complicated discussion centered around nutrition and exercise. Not surprisingly, first-line defense against obesity is always an intervention in nutrition and exercise. There are numerous ways to go about this, some that have some better evidence than others, that result in eating an appropriate amount of calories and improvements in body composition. We'll discuss these in depth in the future, yet still, the vectors of attack against a healthy weight are numerous in modern society. Hyperpalatable, calorically dense foods are cheap and available nearly everywhere we go. Despite numerous attempts to modify diet and exercise in nearly every conceivable way, many are unable to beat obesity. This leaves many frustrated and hopeless, especially when suffering from conditions that significantly worsen in the presence of obesity and result in daily impairments of life. For many, they are looking and desperate for help. One place that many are turning to in greater numbers of recent are medications that treat obesity. The history of weight loss medications is a fascinating one, but one we will leave for another discussion another day. Part of the reason many are starting to consider the use of medications for obesity more regularly is because in the last 5 years, medications have been brought to market which are more effective than any obesity medication ever studied, and by a pretty wide margin. The most effective medication ever studied in a phase 3 trial is a new medication called tirzepatide, or more commonly known by its brand name, Mounjaro. This medication, when given to people with obesity, produced an average weight loss of negative 20.9% at the highest dose. Almost 91% of participants lost greater than 5% of their body weight, and 36%, over one-third, lost greater than 25% of their body weight. These are staggering numbers that catapulted the treatment into mainstream conversations around obesity treatments. Now, to note, tirzepatide and Mounjaro are not currently approved for obesity in the U.S. A phase 3 trial has been completed with a primary indication of obesity, and the medication is rumored to be submitted for an obesity indication approval this year through the FDA, but has not done so yet. We're getting ahead of ourselves, though. First, we have to discuss what exactly tirzepatide or Mounjaro is and how it works. This is an injectable medication that functions by binding both the glucagon-like peptide 1 receptor, or GLP-1 receptor, and the glucose-dependent insulinotropic polypeptide receptor, or the GIP receptor. Bear with me as we quickly go over the mechanism here. The GLP-1 receptor is present in the pancreas, gastrointestinal tract, and neurons. Stimulating it leads to improved glucose-dependent insulin secretion, leading to improved glucose control, delayed gastric transit, and activating anorexigenic pathways in the brain. The GIP receptor, on the other hand, stimulates both glucagon secretion when blood glucose is low and insulin secretion when blood glucose is high. The GIP receptor is present in the pancreas, but unlike the GLP-1 receptor, it's also abundant in adipose tissue. The exact biological effects of stimulating the GIP receptor is by no means clear and is an area of intense investigation. Although there is much more nuance to the mechanism by which tirzepatide works, we'll move on to discussing the phase 3 clinical trial done to evaluate the efficacy and safety of administering it to patients with obesity. This trial was conducted in 9 countries and included over 2,500 adults with a BMI of 30 or greater, or a BMI of 27 or greater and a weight-related comorbidity, such as hypertension, sleep apnea, dyslipidemia, or cardiovascular disease. A BMI of 30 is the diagnostic cutoff to be diagnosed with obesity, which is why that number was picked for the trial. Notably, patients with diabetes, recent body weight change of greater than 5 kilograms in the last 90 days, prior or planned surgical obesity treatment, or patients who had taken a weight loss medication within 90 days were excluded from this trial. The first reason for some of these exclusions is to isolate the effect on obesity independent of other treatments. Additionally, patients with recent weight changes are more likely to have medical reasons for that weight change that would likely require further workup and potential treatment independent of obesity. Finally, diabetes is excluded because trials have already been done demonstrating the effect of tirzepatide on body weight in patients with diabetes. The researchers are looking for new insights on the patients who do not have diabetes. Now let's move on to discuss how the trial was conducted. Participants were assigned either 5, 10, or 15 milligrams of tirzepatide or a placebo injection. They then all administered the injections once per week for 72 weeks. Notably, this was done in addition to dietary and exercise treatments. All groups had regular meetings with a dietitian or healthcare provider to discuss healthy dietary interventions and aimed for a calorie deficit of 500 calories per day, combined with at least 150 minutes of physical activity weekly. Effectively, the only active treatment being received in the placebo group were these lifestyle interventions, while the treatment groups received tirzepatide in addition to try and isolate the effect of the medication beyond the effects seen by diet and exercise. Participants in the tirzepatide group started at a dose of 2.5 milligrams and were increased monthly in 2.5 milligram intervals to the final assigned dose of 5, 10, or 15 milligrams. The co-primary endpoints, which are the targets that determine whether the trial was successful, were the percent of weight loss at 72 weeks and the percent of participants with 5% or more weight loss. These targets are made before the trial begins to ensure that effects seen are real and not just a product of data mining. There were a host of secondary endpoints, which garner slightly less confidence in their outcomes because they were not the primary targets, which we will discuss while going through the results. Of all the participants, 86% completed the trial, and 4.3%, 7.1%, and 6.2% discontinued treatment due to adverse effects in the 5, 10, and 15 milligram tirzepatide groups, respectively. That's compared with 2.6% of the placebo group that dropped out of the trial. The average participant had been obese for nearly 14 and a half years. Their average BMI was 38, and average weight was 104.8 kilograms or 231 pounds. Just over 40% had prediabetes, and almost two-thirds had a comorbidity, as discussed previously. Before going into the results, we should briefly discuss the difference between treatment estimate versus efficacy estimate. Treatment estimate refers to the participants that were assigned to the groups no matter if they completed the trial as prescribed or not. This result provides a good look into how the treatment will generally apply to an entire population, and notably factors discontinue rates into the result. For example, if a patient is taking tirzepatide and is unable to continue taking the medication due to adverse effects, this patient will still be counted into the analysis in a treatment estimate. The efficacy estimate, on the other hand, only includes participants who completed the trial as prescribed. As such, it provides a great look on an individual level as to what an expected result would be if you can take the medication as was done in the trial. The treatment estimate of change in body weight at 72 weeks was minus 15%, minus 19.5%, and minus 20.9% for the 5, 10, and 15 milligram doses of tirzepatide. That's compared to a 3.1% reduction in the placebo group. Subtracting the placebo group numbers gives us the estimated treatment effect of minus 11.9%, minus 16.4%, and minus 17.8% weight loss for the 5, 10, and 15 milligram tirzepatide groups, respectively. As for the efficacy estimate, there was a body weight reduction of minus 16%, minus 21.4%, and minus 22.5% with the 5, 10, and 15 milligram doses of tirzepatide, respectively. That's compared with a 2.4% reduction with placebo. This resulted in an estimated treatment effect of 13.5% for the 5 milligrams, 18.9% for the 10 milligrams, and 20.1% for the 15 milligram tirzepatide groups. A treatment effect of 20% has not been seen in a phase 3 trial prior to this, and truly is an astonishing result. Unsurprisingly, in the efficacy estimate analysis, 96% of participants at 10 milligrams and 15 milligrams lost greater than 5% of their body weight compared to only 35% in the placebo group. Additionally, 36% of participants in the 15 milligram tirzepatide group lost 25% or more of their body weight, compared to only 1.5% of people in the placebo group. These results are nothing short of astounding. The average weight loss in the efficacy estimate 15 milligram tirzepatide group was over 50 pounds. Participants who received tirzepatide were almost certain to lose meaningful body weight greater than 5% and frequently lost over 25% of their body weight. Remember, the placebo group is receiving dietary and exercise interventions on a regular basis. For many patients, losing 25% of their body weight is the goal they have in mind for successful weight loss when they start out on a weight loss journey. Well, in this trial, participants in the tirzepatide group had a real shot at reaching that goal, with 36% of them doing so, whereas the diet and exercise-only group hardly ever reached that goal, with 1.5% of people doing so. This is clearly a life-changing intervention for people, but does the body weight reduction really translate into a healthier life? The following results are for a pooled analysis of 10 milligrams of tirzepatide and 15 milligrams of tirzepatide. Participants had an estimated treatment reduction of minus 6.2 points in systolic blood pressure, which is the top number, and minus 4 points for diastolic blood pressure, the bottom number. LDL cholesterol was reduced by 4.2 milligrams per deciliter, and fasting insulin was reduced by 38.9. Physical functioning was measured using the SF-36 physical functioning score, and a treatment difference of nearly 2 points was seen. Although encouraging that physical functioning improved, and acknowledging that this is possibly one of the more important metrics that a patient would care about, it's unclear the clinical significance of this because the mean for this scale is 50, and I'm uncertain whether a 2-point difference is meaningful on that scale. Interestingly, body composition was measured in a subset of patients and showed that participants unsurprisingly lost both fat mass and lean mass. However, the lean to fat mass ratio improved in these participants, demonstrating that a greater amount of the mass lost was fat mass. The general takeaway from all these numbers is that every health metric that was measured and is important for health is seen to trend in the right direction. This is very encouraging implications, with an emphasis on implications, for the general health effect that tirzepatide has on people with obesity. So great, tirzepatide helped participants lose staggering amounts of weight and resulted in positive trends for health markers we care about. But what are the side effects and drawbacks to taking this medication? There were no significant differences between any of the tirzepatide groups and placebo group when it came to serious adverse effects or death. Despite that, there were significant differences in adverse events leading to discontinuation of the medication at a rate of 6.2% for the 15 milligram tirzepatide group compared with 2.6% for the placebo group. Somewhat shockingly, a less than 5% discontinuation rate above placebo due to adverse effects. As we will see, the occurrence of adverse events was notably higher, however, this did not lead to discontinuation of the medication. I'll discuss the adverse events of the 15 milligram group compared with placebo for simplicity's sake. Nausea occurred in 31% of people with tirzepatide, 9.5% with placebo. Diarrhea occurred in 23% of the tirzepatide group and 7.3% for placebo. Constipation in 11.7% in the tirzepatide group and 5.8% for placebo. Dyspepsia or indigestion occurred in 11.3% of the tirzepatide group and 4.2% of placebo. Vomiting in 12.2% of tirzepatide group, 1.7% of placebo. Alopecia or hair loss, 5.7% of the tirzepatide group, 0.9% of the placebo group. Dizziness in 4.1% of the tirzepatide group, 2.3% of the placebo group. Belching occurred in 5.6% of the tirzepatide group and 0.6% of the placebo group. Notably, there was not a significant difference between the groups in regards to cancer, pancreatitis, gallbladder disorders, cardiac disorders, kidney events, or liver events. With all of those adverse effects, why did participants not stop the medication in greater numbers? Remember, only 3.6% of people above placebo stopped tirzepatide in the 15 milligram group. The reporting of side effects doesn't mean that these side effects were going on all the time while the people were on the medication. It simply means that at some point during the 72 weeks, our participant experienced the side effect. Reportedly with tirzepatide, similar to many GLP-1 receptor agonists, the side effects can occur more frequently around the time of injection and of dose escalation as the body adjusts to the new activation of the GLP-1 receptor and the GIP receptor. In theory, many of these side effects could become much more tolerable or abate completely as the treatment goes on and the body becomes used to the higher dose. To my knowledge, this is a very theoretical, and I don't know that I can point to specific studies or data at the time that bears this specific thing out. Unsurprisingly, many of the effects seen are gastrointestinal in nature, which coincides with the effects of the medication mentioned above on delaying gastric transit. Perhaps the most reassuring part of the side effects mentioned above is that they're almost all completely reversible with cessation of the medication. Of the more permanent and serious side effects, there was not an effect seen in nearly every case. This provides prescribers reassurance that if side effects were to be encountered that were severe enough to stop the medication, they would very likely be reversible. What insights did we gain about tirzepatide in the treatment of obesity through this trial? First and foremost, tirzepatide showed the most impressive obesity treatment data of any medication ever studied in a phase 3 trial up to this point. It was able to provide body weight reductions near 20% at the highest doses for participants who completed treatment. For comparison, semaglutide, better known as Ozempic, produced body weight reduction in the realm of 12 to 15% at the highest dose. Additionally, Mounjaro improved blood pressure, cholesterol levels, insulin levels, and physical functioning of those taking it. Furthermore, less than 5% of participants above the placebo group discontinued the medication because of adverse effects, suggesting that it's extremely well tolerated. Notably, there were frequent gastrointestinal side effects observed, but no obvious evidence of an increase in serious adverse events. Now, I should note that serious adverse events are rare, and so this does not mean that they for sure do not happen, only that this study did not provide evidence that they do in greater numbers for tirzepatide. For some patients for who tirzepatide is effective in, it could represent a long-term solution that solves the obesity problem. Early data seem to indicate that GLP-1 receptor agonists continue a favorable safety profile over the long timeframes. However, when people stop taking these medications, most of the weight that was lost is regained over time. This was demonstrated in the Step 1 extension trial, where semaglutide showed that over 52 weeks, participants went from nearly minus 17% body weight reduction up to 5% body weight reduction. Notably, this was still less than the placebo group, and there was no evidence that being on semaglutide led to more weight gain after stopping it than if it had never been started in the first place. Nevertheless, it is important to know this going in if the medication needs to be stopped for some reason. Additionally, the biggest elephant in the room at the moment is insurance coverage for this medication. Insurance companies are gladly covering tirzepatide when it's used to treat type 2 diabetes, because it's also the most effective non-insulin diabetes treatment on the market currently. Obviously, it's not approved for obesity yet, so insurance companies will not pay for that indication. Currently, it costs in the realm of $1,000 a month to take Mounjaro, which obviously makes it cost prohibitive for nearly everyone. If you look at Wegovy, which is the approved weight loss formulation of semaglutide, we see that most insurance companies are not providing significant coverage for this medication either at the moment, although there are some insurances who do cover it. The biggest reason for this is that these medications have not yet demonstrated improvement in clinical outcomes such as preventing heart disease or strokes, living longer, or reducing the risk of being hospitalized. From the perspective of the insurance companies, they want to see real tangible outcomes demonstrated that will make an appreciable difference in the healthcare costs for that patient. Unfortunately, solely demonstrating weight reduction and well-being improvements is not enough for most insurance companies. So how or when will it be determined if these medications make an appreciable difference on hard clinical outcomes? Well, in a few months, we'll receive data from the SELECT trial, which is evaluating semaglutide's effect on cardiovascular outcomes in patients with obesity and prior cardiovascular disease. It'll provide an excellent window into what the effects of GLP-1 receptor agonists are on these cardiovascular outcomes. With that being said, this data will be for semaglutide and not for tirzepatide. Tirzepatide's cardiovascular outcome data will have to wait for years to come still. Quickly, I want to outline logistically how taking this medication generally works. I want to be clear, none of this is medical advice. I just wanted to note observations from practice to give context to this medication and this clinical trial. Patients are typically started out at the 2.5 milligram dose, which is the lowest dose, which is taken in an injectable form each week. These only last 21 days at room temperature, so often patients will keep one dose or two doses out at room temperature at a time and keep the rest refrigerated. Patients will often take the dose on the same day each week. And oftentimes, side effects can be felt most strongly around the time of taking the dose each week and seem to be affected by the types of food eaten around that same time. Many patients find out what day the work works best for them and can plan accordingly. It seems that the side effects tend to get better over time as the body adjusts to the medication being administered regularly. However, it is crucial that patients let their doctor know about side effects that do occur. There may be mitigation strategies that can improve them. Patients are typically titrated up each month, however, this is very individualized. For example, in a patient who is experiencing nausea on 2.5 milligrams, it may not make sense to increase the dose up to 5 milligrams right away, and instead wait until the patient is better tolerating 2.5 milligrams. There is no set timeline for which patients need to be titrated up. When a patient is either at their treatment goal or at the highest tolerated dose, the medication can be continued at that dose indefinitely. Medication fills are typically for 1 or 3 months, and typically, as patients are being titrated up, 1 month fills are being done, and when a stable dose is reached, then 3 month fills are being utilized. A common question is about this medication being an injection and if it'll be uncomfortable to take. The medication comes in the form of a pen, which gets placed on the skin, most commonly the abdomen. There is no exposed needle that can be seen, and the tiny needle only is exposed when the button is pressed on the pen and the needle enters the skin for brief seconds. Most patients report that they don't feel or barely feel the injection at all, and I've yet to have a patient report that the injection itself stopped them from taking the medication. Furthermore, many patients actually come to prefer the once-weekly dosing over the daily dosing of oral medications. Now, two big questions that are being posed about these obesity medications are, one, what happens when people stop the medications, and why should people take a medication forever? And two, how much muscle mass are people losing when taking these medications, and should we be concerned? The first we addressed briefly above. These medications activate signaling pathways in the body that reliably lead to weight loss. However, these medications are not making permanent changes to those signaling pathways, they're only temporarily stimulating them. Thus, perhaps unsurprisingly, when the medications are stopped, patients tend to gain weight back that was lost. Again, there was no evidence that people gained back excess weight from where they started. People actually still had lost a small amount compared to placebo, but weight was returning near their baseline. To make a permanent change using a similar mechanism would require a genetic alteration that would impact the amount of GLP-1 produced by the body forever. The other permanent change, of course, is bariatric surgery, where the anatomy and subsequent physiology of the stomach is permanently altered. Obviously, permanent changes have their own set of benefits and drawbacks. As far as we know, there have not been any additional severe side effects which develop over longer timeframes that weren't identified in the original studies, and so up to this point, there haven't been additional concerns identified with long-term use of these medications. There certainly are cost considerations with using these medications year after year, and that should be factored into patients' plan when considering starting these medications. Next, discussing muscle mass losses, which we also touched on briefly, patients do lose muscle mass when starting tirzepatide. This should be expected with any form of weight loss. The important question is how much muscle mass do they lose and should we be concerned about it? From this trial, we saw that patients lost more fat mass than lean mass, and their lean mass to fat mass ratio improved. This is in concordance with prior trials of semaglutide, which demonstrated an improved lean mass to fat mass ratio. Losses seem to be roughly in a 2-to-1 fat mass to lean mass ratio, and preliminary analysis seems to suggest that percent of lean mass lost on semaglutide is comparable to lean mass losses seen with regular weight loss via dietary changes. Thus, I'm not sure additional concern is warranted above the normal concerns when a patient is losing weight through their diet. Of course, preserving lean mass is important, and we should work to do so. However, it appears that lean mass losses with GLP-1 receptor agonists are largely in line with lean mass losses seen with weight loss via diet and exercise. Strategies we can employ to reduce the lean mass losses seen with weight loss include increasing our protein intake and performing weight-bearing exercises. However, to reiterate, patients' body composition improved with lean mass to fat mass ratios improving when taking tirzepatide. I want to again reiterate that tirzepatide for obesity is planned to be submitted to the FDA this year, and it's not currently approved for the treatment of obesity at this time in the United States. With that said, this trial sent shockwaves throughout the obesity treatment space. Just as much as the raw treatment effect on body weight is impressive, the improvement in health biomarkers is arguably even more important. Not only were people living at a healthier weight after taking tirzepatide, but they were showing signs of having better overall health as well. We won't know for some years whether tirzepatide reduces cardiovascular risk in people at high risk with obesity, although trials with similar medications might provide clues earlier. Yet nonetheless, this trial and others like it provide a breakthrough in our ability to defend against the onslaught of obesity that has plagued our world more and more in recent years. In the future, we will go into many more treatments that are approved or in development for obesity. Beyond medications, there is the world of bariatric surgery, which has the most impressive weight loss and mortality data of any treatment currently available. Additionally, we'll discuss medications undergoing Phase 2 and Phase 3 trials currently, which are on track to potentially surpass even the stellar data of tirzepatide. The information provided in this podcast is intended for general educational and informational purposes only and is not a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. The contents of this podcast do not constitute medical advice and should not be relied upon as such. If you have any concerns or questions about your health, please consult with a qualified healthcare professional. The hosts and guests of this podcast do not make any representations or warranties concerning the accuracy, completeness, or suitability of the information provided in this podcast, and will not be liable for any damages arising from your reliance on such information. Listeners should always seek the advice of a qualified healthcare professional before making any decisions regarding their health.